And at this time, it is a great pleasure that I present to you, my friend and yours, Virgil W. of Decatur, Georgia.
Thank you, Dick. And hi, everybody. I want to thank this North Carolina Conference Committee for extending to me the privilege of being with you and sharing with you what little I have to offer. Before I start, there are two people here who I'm going to mention from time to time in my story, and I'd like for you to meet them. There's a girl here that I love more than anything in this world and have loved and has been a part of my life for more than 33 years now. And I'd like for you to meet Margaret. And another one that I didn't have too much use for in the beginning. But without him, there was a block or two that I could have stumbled over and maybe not been here today. I have the privilege and want you to meet my sponsor, Russell. My name is Virgil Warren, and I am a sober alcoholic. Sober by the grace of God and the instrument that He chose to grant me this sobriety, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the connotation of those two words, sober alcoholic. And it reminds me always of a story that I love to tell, and if you've heard it, please don't stop me. Seems that there were two girls that had attended college together and graduated and hadn't seen each other in a number of years. They bumped into each other in town one day while on a shopping tour and were delighted to see each other. And they began to discuss old times and decided that they wanted to talk more. And it appeared that one of these girls lived out in the country and she had a little boy about 11 or 12 years old. And the other one was a city girl, had a daughter about the same age, 11 or 12, and they arranged to meet out in the country one Sunday and have dinner and reminisce over their college days. And when the time came, the lady in the country called her little boy to her and said, "Son," said, "this couple coming out, said, I want you to know that they're Catholic. You realize that we are Protestants, and I don't want the subject of religion brought up this afternoon. We want to have a good time." And the little boy promised, and the day came, and he lived up quite well to his promise until late in the afternoon. He asked the little girl if she wanted to go swimming. The little girl told him that she would love to, but that she didn't bring her bathing suit. He said, "Oh, out here in the country," he said, "we don't swim in bathing suits. We just throw our clothes over the bushes and swim in the creek." So the little girl agreed to go, and they went down to the creek, and they took their clothes off, and they threw them over to the bushes. And the little boy turned around, and he looked at the little girl. He said, "You know, I never knew before how much difference there was in a Catholic and a Protestant." And you know there's a difference in alcoholics. Depending on which angle that I approach the subject, it seems like it's been a very short time ago, and then again a long time, that I attended my first meeting at the Decatur Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Atlanta. And looking back on that meeting, into my inventory, which is where practically all of my story comes from, I see my first real realization of insanity. I sat on that back row thinking on one hand that I didn't belong there, that I wasn't an alcoholic, that these people were a bunch of hypocrites. And I listened to a speaker up in front of the room talk, and I thought that he was lying and he was bragging and he was stretching the truth. And at the same identical time that these thoughts were running through my mind, I was saying to myself, I can top anything that guy's told, and I could. I continued to go to AA in Decatur. I'd go for a couple of weeks, and then I'd get drunk. Come back for a couple of more weeks, and this went on, and I sat on the back row and I listened. And I'd hear these many people get up before the group, and I would hear each one of them say that I came from a good Christian family. And this was a little bit puzzling to me. I couldn't understand how all of these alcoholics came from good Christian families. And the only thing that I could figure out for an answer was that good Christians just weren't very adept at raising children. And I said to myself that if they ever asked me to talk in this program, I'm going to tell the truth. I'm going to tell them that I came from a normal or average family. We had some good Christians in it. We had some alcoholics in it, and we had some nuts in it. And that I turned out to be the alcoholic nut. But one of those good Christians in that family was my mother. My mother was a very devout Methodist. And I can recall many, many times when this good mother of mine would have me sit at her knee, and she would tell me the story of Peter and Luke and John. And this mother taught me to dream. She taught me to have ambition. And this mother had ambition. She wanted her eldest son to become a Methodist minister. And this became my dream, and it became my ambition. And this is the way I lived on up until about my next to last year in high school. And I began to notice around me that I was beginning to get the title of a panty waist. And it hurt, and I couldn't understand it, because I played on the football, baseball, and basketball teams in high school. I couldn't understand how an athlete could be a panty waist. But as time dragged on, I noticed that a majority of these kids began to ignore me. And I began to notice that at the dances that Ever so often they would run out of the dance to the automobiles. And when they came back from these automobiles, they seemed to be laughing more and having more fun. And I followed some of them out to the cars one day, and I noticed that they were drinking corn whiskey and straight alcohol and chasing it with Coca-Colas and ginger ale. And I stood there and I asked one of those boys to let me try some of that, and he handed me the bottle and he handed me the Coca-Cola. And I took my first drink at the age of 17 outside of a dance in Atlanta. And I've heard many speakers say that they became an alcoholic 4, 5, 6 years before they came in this program. That's their opinion. They're entitled to it, and I certainly don't want to get in any controversy with them over it. Personally, I believe they are speaking of compulsive alcoholism or pathological alcoholism or whatever the case might be. I believe that I became an alcoholic when I took that first drink standing beside that automobile. Because I have learned from you in Alcoholics Anonymous that when anything becomes important in our lives, whether that thing be good or bad, it begins to shape, form, and fashion our lives. And alcohol became important to me with that first drink. From that point on, when I was invited to a party, I wanted to know where it was and who was going to be there. That way I knew if there were going to be drinking. And you know, normal people just don't do that. They go to a party because they are invited, and if the host should happen to offer them a drink, it is their prerogative to accept it or refuse it. Then I can recall the boys inviting me to go down to Athens to see the University of Georgia play, and I wanted to know who was going, so I would know if it was a drinking crowd or not, and if it wasn't, I didn't want to go. I've learned many years later that there's thousands and thousands of people go down to Athens on Saturday to see the football game. Normal people do. So I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. It influenced my life, this cunning, baffling alcohol. I continued on through high school till about 2 months before I was to graduate, and all of a sudden it dawned on me, Virgil, you're going to graduate from this school in about 2 months, and then next September you're going off to theology college to become a minister. And the Methodist Church is a little narrow-minded. They resent their ministers running around with girls at night and getting drunk and getting in fights. And I had to make a decision at the age of 18. And I weighed this God of mine in one hand and a bottle of liquor in the other. And I looked at this God of mine, and in him I saw a man that must become a partner in my life. A man for whom I must make an example of my life. I must make an example for my congregation and for my community, and it scared me. And I looked at this bottle of liquor in the other hand, and as we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, this appeared to be the easy way out. This way, I could manage my own life. and this bottle of liquor outweighed my God. When I graduated from high school, that June I ran. I didn't know it then. I ran all out through the West and wound up in Long Beach, California. Just before Christmas that year, I had this feeling to come home. I didn't know what it was then, I do now. And I came home and was accepted back into my family as if I'd been down to the corner grocery after a loaf of bread, and life took up where it had left off. Then in February of that year, I knew why I was called back. This mother that I loved so much passed away. And I can recall of having a sense of relief at her death. Not of her dying, but of the fact that now I can manage my own life again. At the age of 19, I was coming to believe that it was my mother that wanted me to be the minister, not me. She was interfering in my life. And then in August of that summer, I had a rude awakening and began to have my first taste of resentments. My father called me to him and told me that we had to go to town and buy some clothes. We were going off for me to go off to school in September. And I couldn't believe that he wanted me to be a minister. I chose to believe that he wanted to get rid of me. And that was my choice. But nevertheless, off to theology college in September I went. And I have looked back over that 9-month period in that school many, many times. And I cannot find one instant where I wasn't happy and content, satisfied with my lot in life. And yet I came home one weekend, and when I got ready to go back one Sunday, I went by the bootleggers and I picked up a fifth of whiskey and I carried it back to school with me. And I did just exactly what an alcoholic would do. I got drunk and caused a disturbance in the dormitory. And one of the professors came down and surveyed the situation and wisely stayed out of it. He merely told me to be at the dean's office at 10 o'clock the next morning. And I was there. And this fine man read me the riot act as he should have. And then at the end of it, he looked over at me and made a mistake. He didn't know he was talking to a budding alcoholic, and I was just ready for somebody to start whetting my ego. He said, "Virgil, I had intended to expel you from this school where you couldn't attend another college in the state of Georgia. Due to your record, I'm going to give you the opportunity to resign." I had to ask him what it was. And the gentleman told me that to his amazement that I was leading my class. I left that school and headed home. I can recall very vividly my thoughts on the way home that, my God, what kind of a school was this? Here I was, a boy at their own admission. Could have been the greatest minister that denomination had ever known, and they asked for my resignation. And I wanted to know, what kind of a God did I have? That here I was, A young man that was willing to sacrifice his life to go out in the world and preach his gospel. And he let this happen to me. And I knew that was wrong. This man had told me that I was a great student of the Bible, and I knew that in 31st Proverbs, the 7th verse, it says to go out into the world and get drunk and forget your poverty and hunger. Now, some of you drunks might have not known that was in there. But it's a beautiful excuse to get drunk. Bible says it's all right. Says to do it. And how typically it is of the thoughts of an alcoholic. You know, we come into this program and we hear members say, why, you just must stay sober a day at a time. And we think we've found something new, something wonderful. And it is wonderful, but it's not new. I never heard of an alcoholic in my life that lived over one day at a time. For years before we got here, I wasn't interested in what happened yesterday and wasn't concerned about what was going to happen tomorrow. All I was concerned about was today. And our thoughts ran in the same manner. That verse in the Bible excused what I was doing, and I completely ignored the preceding verse in front of it, which says, if you are intent on self-destruction. It was ignored. I came back to Atlanta and I entered Georgia Tech. I know now on a process of another alcoholic trait of proving something to somebody when really it was me. I wanted to prove to people that Virgil still had it. And I went to Georgia Tech for 2 years. And at the end of that 2 years, I told everybody that I had learned everything that Georgia Tech had to offer. I was going to quit and go to work. That wasn't the truth. The truth is that you can't go to Georgia Tech and pass and drink every night. And not only that, it's awful hard to become an alcoholic on the allowance that your dad gives you to go to school. So I had to quit and go to work. Shortly after leaving Tech, I met Margaret and we were married and started out on life's road together. It's not really necessary that I go over in detail the next 18 years of my life. I was successful in spite of a bottle of alcohol. And I would like to emphasize that in spite of, it wasn't with a bottle of alcohol, in spite of one. And at the end of that 18 years, I had just about run my race. I'd become assistant to the president of one of Georgia's larger corporations. And our president had resigned, and it was a board of directors meeting to select another one. And while sitting in that meeting, the chairman of the board directed two statements directly at me, and they ran off of my back like water off of a duck's back. He made the statement that he was not going to elect a president at that meeting, that he was going to wait and see what happened. Another ambitious man in that room got up and asked him if he had any idea who the next president would be, and he said yes. That if Virgil handed his cigars out in the proper manner, he would be the next president. And I left that room very egotistically and went out and celebrated for the next 6 months that I had become president of that corporation. And I was sitting in my office one morning, and my secretary came in and said, "Mr. Warren, the chairman of the board, wants you in his office." I knew what he wanted, and I straightened my tie and combed my hair and put my coat on and marched up to his office to accept the presidency of this corporation. And when I walked through the door, I saw this fine gentleman sitting behind his desk with tears running down his cheeks. And he looked up at me and he said, "Virgil, I have prayed. I had hoped it wouldn't be necessary to make this statement to you, but I must ask you for your resignation." And that's how I became president of that large corporation. Egotistically, crying on the inside with a heart that was about to break, I looked this man straight in the eye and I said, "Well, who did you name president?" And he told me. I said, "Well, you named the right man. If you'd have fired him, he'd have starved to death. I can make more money than your presidency calls for, and I'll prove it to you." And I went out on the road for the next 2 years to prove to him that he had made a mistake. My dying gasp at sobriety, any control whatsoever. I worked hard for those 2 years, and at the end of it, I was making more money than his presidency called for. I had it in black and white on a piece of paper, and I called this man and I asked him for an appointment, and he was happy to see me. And I marched over to his office and very vehemently laid it on his desk, and I said, "See there, you were wrong." Little did I know when I put that paper on that man's desk that that was the beginning of the end. I was traveling the 6 southeastern states then as a manufacturer's representative. And nobody on the face of this earth could have told me that it, other than it wasn't necessary for me to wine and dine my customers and carry them to bars and nightclubs. But it wasn't long till these men began to find something else to do at night. And I resented them. And it caused me to enter into one of the loneliest lives in the world of sitting in a hotel room and looking at 4 walls and learning how to hate and despise and resent people. To think about this God of mine and not realizing that life's greatest tragedy, it's when we lose God and don't even miss Him. And this was mine. I tried everything to get out of this mess. And then the hallucinations and the blackouts began. I asked a doctor friend of mine one time, "How many blackouts you had to have before it affected your mind?" And he told me 3. So I want you people to know from this point on that you're listening to a blithering idiot. Only God knows how many times I got out of a bed and dressed and packed and checked out of a hotel and drove 250, 300 miles and waked up in another one and not remembered leaving the first one. And how I would drive down the road in my automobile, listening to hillbilly music on my radio and getting tired of listening, reaching over and pushing the button on the radio and changing it to classical music. And the radio wasn't even on. All this began to scare me. I was going through what we know as running scared. And I began to sit in my hotel room at night and think about this subject. I thought about talking to God again, and I tried, and it didn't work. The only thoughts that I had was that here I am, that same little boy, so immature. And I wanted to run and get back down at my mother's knee again, and I wanted to say, "Mother, your little boy is in trouble. Won't you please tell him what to do?" But we can't run back home to Mother anymore. We're adults. This is our problem. This was my problem. And I alone, was the only person on the face of this earth that could do anything about it. And I didn't know how. I was like the story of the traveling salesman that came down from his room in the hotel one day, and he walked up to the desk clerk and he slammed his suitcase down on the floor. And he said, "Buddy boy, this is the last time I'll ever spend the night in your hotel." The clerk said, "Well, sir, what seems to be the problem?" He said, "Well, I didn't get a wink of sleep last night, not one." Clerk said, "Well, sir, what was the problem?" He said, "Well, some dizzy blonde was banging on my door all night long." Clerk said, "Well, sir, why didn't you get up and see what she wanted?" He said, "I knew what she wanted. She wanted out." That's what I wanted. I wanted out. And I only knew one escape. I knew that back home I had a keeper. And you can show me any alcoholic in the world, and I can show you a keeper. I knew that I could go back to this keeper and get within the four walls of that home, and I could be safe. So I went back home. I went back to live 3 or 4 years of hell on earth, to lose everything that I had, except a wife and a son. I went back to that home to pace that floor like an animal, stinking, smelling, often having shaved, had a bath, or changed clothes for 2 and 3 weeks at a time, pacing back and forth and holding my arms up and saying, "Oh God, how can you do this to me?" This great Virgil that was going to conquer the world without God and without anybody was now a stinking coward. Stinking, smelling coward with every sign of manhood gone. God only knows how many times I would go into the bed of this son of mine at night, sit on the side of his bed crying and saying, "Son, your daddy is not going to get up in the morning and take a drink. and have this fine boy look up at me and say, "Yes, Daddy, I know." Yes, he knew better than his daddy did. He knew that I was going to have to get up in the morning and take a drink. How many times I sat in my chair and had this wonderful boy that loved me more than anything in the world to look at me and see despair and misunderstanding and hurt in his eyes. And I couldn't take it, and I'd have to go get another drink and blot it out. And see this girl that loved me so much, and see the hurt and the bewilderment. And I couldn't take that either, and I'd have to go take a drink and blot that out. And then her family and my family began to meddle in our lives. People that loved us so much but didn't know what to do, but wanted to try. Friends. And then the ministers began to come. Fine, wonderful men that loved us and wanted to help. And would come and sit and talk to me and tell me that I had to have a faith in God and I had to believe and that I had to get down on my knees and pray. But these fine men didn't understand. These men didn't understand that Virgil had nothing left to pray with. But there was one that did understand. God understood. And God knew that if Virgil was going to find sobriety, that he was going to have to create one of his miracles. And he did. For one day there was a knock on my door, and when I opened it, there stood a man and a woman, well-dressed, looking good one Sunday morning. It was a couple that Margaret and I had drank with many, many times. Two pitiful alcoholics. And they looked good. And they wanted to come in, and they sat down and told us that they had been in the Decatur group sober for about 2 months, and they would like for us to go with them. And Margaret was more gullible than I was. She dressed and went. She hasn't had a drink since. But I wouldn't go. About 2 weeks later, this man came back again, and he said, "Virgil, I'm going to chair my first meeting at Decatur this afternoon, and I sure wish you would be there." And I went, and that's where I found myself, sitting on that back row. I didn't go for Virgil. I went because it might help him. He had asked me. This went on for 4 or 5 months. And finally it dawned on me, "Virgil, with a brilliant mind like you have, you have the wealth of knowledge at alcoholism at your fingertips right in this group. Why don't you use it?" And I began to listen. I told myself, if you don't make the mistakes that these people made, if you don't do the things that they did, then you can drink and not be like them. So I listened. And I stayed sober for a month and listened well. And then one Monday morning, I got in my automobile and headed for Savannah, Georgia, to have a slip. I got into Savannah late in the afternoon on Monday, and I checked in and I went down to the Sapphire Room and I ordered myself a couple of bottles of beer. And then I ate dinner and I got me a newspaper and I went to bed. And about 10, 11 o'clock, I was congratulating myself very highly. I said, "See there, Virgil, you've got it. Those people were wrong. You not only had one drink, which they said would make you drunk, you had two. And here you are." I got up Tuesday morning and I worked hard all day Tuesday. And I came in Tuesday night and I went into the Sapphire Room and I had three vodka martinis. And I ate, and I got me a magazine, and I went to bed and was laying there reading. And about 10:30, 11 o'clock again, I was congratulating myself very highly. I said, "See there, Virgil, two nights in a row. You've proved those people wrong. You can drink. And for having done such a thing, you deserve a nightcap." And I got up out of that bed Tuesday night and went back to the Sapphire Room for a nightcap. Friday night, there was a knock on my door. And I opened it, and there were two men there. I didn't know where they came from. But they were there. I learned later that there had been a lot of telephone calls going back and forth between Atlanta and Savannah. And I learned that my eventual sponsor was coming down the next day to get me. And their purpose for being there was to keep me from leaving. Well, late Saturday afternoon, Russell came in with Dan, another alcoholic who had driven him down. And they checked me out of the hotel and put me in the car, and we headed back to Atlanta. I think I learned my first real lesson of Alcoholics Anonymous then. I felt that somebody cared something about me. At least Russell did. Here was a man that was a Presbyterian minister and a member of our fellowship, hardly knew me. He had to preach a sermon Sunday morning in his church, and yet he made a round trip of 500 miles to get a drunk out of a hotel and bring him back to Atlanta. I don't remember much that was said on that trip, but I do remember later it came to me, and some people say you can't talk to a drunk, but a lot of it registers, and this registered with me. Russell told me, "Virgil, if you expect to make this program, there are three things you're going to have to do. One of them is you're going to have faith in Virgil. You have got to believe that you can stay sober. Secondly, you've got to have faith in this program and the people in this program. You've got to believe that there's help there. Third, you've got to have faith in a God. You can't do it alone. You're not strong enough. You must get your strength from a power greater than you are." Russell brought me back home and deposited me with my wife, and I sat down in my sobering up chair, and for 2 days I sat and I looked at a TV set, not knowing what was on it, not really caring, just something to look at. And all of a sudden, I heard the word faith. This word faith seemed to leap out of that TV set as if to say, Virgil, wake up and listen. This is what you've been waiting for. And I waked up and I listened. You know, it's a strange thing about people, particularly alcoholics, that no matter where we are, we expect to find God somewhere else. When I waked up and looked at that TV set, of all things, it was Yancey Derringer program. And there was an old man on there with Yancey, and he had told Yancey he was going out west to find an oil well. And Yancey had asked him how he was going to find it, and the old man had said, by faith. And Yancey had asked him what faith was. And the old man replied that faith was the evidence of things not seen, the substance of things hoped for. I got up out of my chair and went into my den and picked up my Bible that I hadn't had my hands on in a number of years. And without hesitation, turned to the 11th chapter, the first verse of Hebrews, and there was what the old man had quoted. I carried it back and I read the entirety of that chapter, which has more evidences of faith than any other portion. Thank God I haven't had a drink up to now. I went back into Alcoholics Anonymous to put all of my efforts and energies in it, to seek sobriety, to find it, but I didn't. I listened to the wrong people. I didn't know that I could not find a serenity of spirit until I gained my own self-possession. I didn't know that as long as I left other people decide whether I should be elated or sad, or happy or depressed, that I would never find my self-possession, which was ultimately all that I possessed. And I listened to people say, if you don't like what you hear, forget it. And I forgot it. And I heard people say that if you can't take the second step, forget it, take the third. If you can't take the third step, skip it, take the fifth. And I was skipping them. I didn't realize that a brick mason can't lay the second layer of brick till he lays the first one. I didn't realize he couldn't lay the fourth layer till he laid the third. So for 9 long months, I was more or less miserable. And I almost got drunk. I didn't know that Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't a program to get us sober. I thought that it was. And I began to think to myself that I don't need this program. I've been sober 10,000 times and I didn't need the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. I heard to learn later that it wasn't. I had to learn later that that wasn't my problem, getting sober. My problem was staying away from that first drink after I was sober. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is for, to teach us a way of life, a good, happy way of life, that we're content without taking that first drink. And another big lesson that I had to learn was the fact that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous won't work. I kept sitting on my fanny, waiting for this program to work. And I had to learn that it won't work. Harold mentioned it briefly last night. We have a big book. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is between the front cover and the back cover of that big book. And the contents of that big book is a set of instructions. A set of instructions for sobriety. Now, I can follow those instructions. I can work those instructions. And I can find sobriety. Those instructions are just like you going out and buying a do-it-yourself kit to put a table together. You can read those instructions until you're blue in the face, and that table will never go together till you get up and follow those instructions and put it together. And AA won't work unless you work it. And it's beautiful. I looked at God in this program and said, what do I need with it? I jumped on the people of our group because they hadn't found me a job. For 9 long months I hadn't had a job. I know now that was God's plan. I had never been a father to my son. And that summer he had asked me to come down to the Little League ballpark while he played ball. And I went with him. And there was a man managing a team down there that had known me back in the past. And he asked me, would I help him? And I was glad to. I worked all summer with this man, with this ball club. And then that winter, when our doubts was the greatest, it was one of the coldest winters that we have had in Atlanta in many, many years. Ice and snow was all over the ground. Telephone lines were down and trees. And it began to come to me, Virgil, this past summer, you taught those little boys in Little League to say the Lord's Prayer. It's a beautiful sight to see them standing up on those dugout steps with the caps over their hearts and saying the Lord's Prayer. And I can recall one day that our ball club looked awful bad, and this manager and I were discussing it, and I felt a tug on my trousers leg. We couldn't understand what was the matter with the little boys. And I looked down, and this little boy looked up at me, and he said, Mr. Warren, I can tell you what's the matter with them. We forgot to say the Lord's Prayer before the game. And we were in a hurry. Now, I know this had nothing to do with that ball game, but the thoughts came to me, Virgil, you taught those little boys the meaning of prayer. But how about you? There's a difference in prayer and praying. And then that same summer, one of our little boys was on his way home from the ballpark on his bicycle. And on his way home, this drunk came down the road in an automobile and ran him off the road, and the little boy fell over, and his head hit the curbstone, and he was killed. And this little boy's parents, knowing how much that Jimmy loved Little League, they had gone to the officials of the league and asked them if they could have his uniform to bury him in. And the league graciously gave it to them. And then they went up into the Decatur Cemetery, and they bought a lot on the side of a hill overlooking the Little League ballpark. And there they buried Little Jimmy. Now, when my doubts was the greatest, I began to wonder if Little Jimmy was cold or if he was warm up in that cemetery. And I drove my car up in there as far as I could drive, and then I got out and I began to walk. Walked on one of the most beautiful days that I have ever seen in my life. Snow, beautiful snow all over the ground that hadn't been touched. Bluish sky and the whitest clouds, and not a twig was moving on a tree. As if God had set this stage, and I was sure he had. And I walked down to Little Jimmy's grave, and when I got there, I saw where a little dog had run over it, and thought that Little Jimmy would like that. And I leaned against that tombstone, and I looked out across that Little League ballpark, and I felt the greatest sense of shame and guilt run over me. Here was a little boy that had barely tasted the fruits of life. A little boy like I was, with dreams and ambitions, and a drunk like me came along and took him away from him. A drunk that had gnawed and chewed at everything that life had to offer. And if he didn't like the taste of it, spit it out. And it hurt. And the realization that I, too, could put me, a little boy, on the side of that hill. And I didn't have to get drunk for a month, a week, or even one day. All I had to do was to take one drink to become qualified to put me, a little Jimmy, on that hill. And I remember crying with all my heart, God, what I can't I find what those people have found? I felt as if God put his hand on my shoulder that day. And one of the most wonderful meditations I have had with him. And he told me, Virgil, you've got to have a new beginning. And that new beginning has got to be now. You can't drag this mess along with you. And I didn't promise you tomorrow. Today. He reminded me of a story in Luke. It says that he who sets his hands to the plow and looks back is not worthy of the kingdom of God. And that's what I had been doing. I left that meeting and I went back into my group, and the strangest thing happened. I began to look in the eyes of those hypocrites, and I began to see love. And I didn't understand it. And I had to go to my sponsor again, that I hadn't been to before. You see, I didn't need a sponsor before. I was too brilliant. I was too smart. Now I needed one. I was on the verge of calamity again, and I needed help. Russell told me, Virgil, that love that you see in those people's eyes is a reflection of your own love. That you can't receive love until you learn to love first. And I began to love these people. I began to learn the meaning of love. I didn't know about this fine girl that God had given me. She was a possession of mine. And this wonderful son that he'd given to us was a possession. Now we were a family. We could hold hands and walk together. Margaret and I began to go all over everywhere and do everything that we could for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we still do. And I've wondered many times how this program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. What makes it work? I've heard many explanations. I'd like to tell you how it works for me. I recall the parable of Luke and John, Peter and John, when they were walking down the road to the temple shortly after the crucifixion of our Lord. And on their way, they passed a lame, crippled beggar sitting on the side of the road begging for alms. Peter walked over to this beggar and he reached out and he said, "Here, take my hand and come walk with us." And the beggar reached up and he took Peter's hand and he got up and he walked into the temple with them. And on the way into the temple, the parable goes on that this beggar jumped and leaped with joy at his soundness of mind and body. And when they came out of the temple, all of the Pharisees gathered around and said, "How did you do it?" And Peter replied, "Through Christ, through the Christ that you so recently condemned." I was a lame, crippled beggar sitting on the side of the road begging for alms. And Alcoholics Anonymous came by and reached out their hand and said, "Here, take my hand and come walk with us." And I took AA's hand and walked with them. And I too jumped and leaped with joy at my soundness of mind and body. And how does AA work? Through Christ. Through the Christ that I had so recently condemned. You wonderful people of Alcoholics Anonymous took my hand and showed me the way back to an infinite power. A power that could restore me to sanity. A power to whom I could turn over my will and my life. And I must make an example of my life for this God of mine. You know, the God of my understanding is not dead. I'm terribly sorry about yours. I must make an example of myself, not for people to look up to, but for people to look, take my hand and look up with. Not an example for people to follow, but an example for people to take my hand and walk with. For this I'll be ever indebted to you, grateful to you for bringing this message to me of my God. And each day of my life that goes by, I pray that this God of mine will forbid me from knowingly committing the greatest of all sins, that one of refusing mercy to my fellow man. God did not grant you and I the privilege of attenuated judgment. For when I stand before the throne of my God for final judgment, I do not want to say, "No, Lord, I didn't help that man, for in my opinion, he was a hopeless drunk." For the God of my understanding said, "Whatsoever you do unto the least of these, also you do unto me." What did your God say? Thank you.